Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Second half is getting underway very shortly at the Etihad, where it's Manchester City 1, Wolves 0. Man City dominant in this game, but only an own goal to show for it. And Donker putting the ball into his own net, but Man City in complete control thus far. Second half about to get underway. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Mark Lawrenson. He's going to pay tribute to Ian St. John, who sadly passed away. In the meantime, Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent is with us. Good evening.
Evening, Joe.
World Cup 2030. Here we go. This is the one, Dan. This is the one. I can feel it.
Can you? Why are you excited about this? Why is anyone excited about this? Like, this story has been around since September 2018. Like, we need to ask ourselves, Why is this a story now? What's happening?
Good night, everyone. That was the football show. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Tom Dunn's on the way.
I'm just saying, like, I feel like, you know, people are sort of trapped in some kind of deja vu where they're like, I feel like I've heard about this before, you know? But all of a sudden, Boris is saying it, and Micheál Martin is saying it, and even, like, I watched the TV news tonight there. It looks like every political leader at the plinth today outside the Dáil was asked about the World Cup bid, which is a story that clearly has just broken in Leinster House, whereas everyone else has been dealing with this for like a long period of time. Like, Jonathan Hill only spoke last Friday about the World Cup bid and what was going on with that. But clearly the fact that the UK government have said that they're going to, so Boris has told the Sun that they're going to support this feasibility study. The feasibility study that was launched 2 years ago and was supported by Theresa May at the time, as was reported at the time. But this is now suddenly, this is the story of the day. There's nothing else going on. Nothing else to see here, Joe. Everything else is going absolutely fine. Let's talk about the World Cup, because what the people need is a good news story to distract them from real life, because that's clearly what's going on here. Because I saw this alert last night. I was off. I saw stories about Ireland to bid for the World Cup. I was like, oh, they've progressed the study on to formalising the fact that they've launched a bid. And it's like, no, they haven't. They're just putting some money towards the study. But hey, it's been analysed all day, everywhere and anywhere, Joe. So let's bring it on. World Cup 2030. What's going to happen? Are they going to bring it to Turl? You know, bring it to Tipperary, bring it to fucking, you know, Cork, wherever else we're going to go.
You're such a non-GAA person. You were about to you were about to say Thurles and then just thought, I'm not quite sure, so I'll go with Tipperary. That's what happened there, my friend, and we all spotted it, so don't think we didn't.
Yeah, it's true.
I'm gonna Dave Jones you, Jamie Redknapp, and say, take a breath.
I'm pretty relaxed about the whole thing, I have to say.
Take a breath and listen to the Minister of State for Sport, Jack Chambers. He was on News Talk Breakfast this morning with Shane Coleman. Very excited.
We had an announcement from Prime Minister Johnson yesterday on the British government positively embracing this. And what's being worked through now across the five football associations, the five nations who represent football on the two islands, and the Irish government is working through the feasibility of this. We want to embrace this in a really positive way. I think it's a great opportunity in terms of tourism and economic benefits if we embrace this. And we are at an early stage. It's just important to say that as well. So a bid will be submitted between 2022 and 2024 when FIFA open the bidding process. But I think it represents a huge opportunity for our two islands to present our credentials to the globe, and also from a footballing perspective.
Well, what would we be talking about in terms of number of games and where those games would take place?
Yeah, so that's what's being worked through now, Shane, in the whole feasibility process. So the whole, obviously, the stadia, the infrastructure demands, the tourism benefit, and the whole economic basis for such a bid.
Okay, and I accept it's early days yet, but it's likely. Yep. Is it likely to just be Aviva and Croke Park? Is that the most likely outcome?
I wouldn't say that. No, I mean, if you look at as part of the Rugby World Cup bid, we had other stadia, and I think it's also important we have a regional component to any such bid.
I mean, I know we have Parky Queeve, it's 50,000, but is more than half it? I think is terracing, which will not do for a World Cup.
Well, that's something that officials in my own department working with the FAI, we will obviously try and maximise the regional benefit and try and ensure that the various stadia that are throughout the country, as you've mentioned, Cork and Limerick, also the north-south dimension is important. So and we've the Football Association in the North involved as well. And so what's being worked through now as part of the feasibility process is to formalise what stadia will be involved, the infrastructure demands, and the whole economic.
Okay. How much is the bid going to cost us?
That has yet to be worked out, Shane, and that's part of the feasibility process that's underway, and the collaboration that's ongoing now between the two respective governments and the football associations will work through that. And when that's formalised, when a bid is submitted, as I said, it's between 2022 and 2024 when such a bid is submitted. But as you know, we have a huge footballing family. We're a huge sporting nation. Yeah. And I think the Irish people expect us to put our best foot forward, and also from a tourism perspective, that we look at the tourism and economic benefits. It's one of the biggest events in the world, and I think the fact that
a few group games and a quarter final, maybe. Like, there wouldn't be that big a tourism bonus from that, would there?
Oh, I want to hear the answer.
Yeah, you don't need to hear it, to be honest. I mean, I've heard all the other answers. It tells you all to know. I mean, like, I love that. Like, this is at a very early stage. It's an early stage for these government, you know, for our government, certainly. But this has been going on for 3 years. Lest we forget, Joe, do we remember one of the great, what would you say is the greatest modern announcement of Irish football recent times? I'm going to preempt you on this and say it was the announcement of John Delaney's title as executive vice president of the FAI. Was there a greater moment? Can we remember what John Delaney's job spec was for executive vice president? Do you remember what it was? Because I'll tell you what it was. One key part of it was dealing with the very important Euro 2020 tournament and World Cup 2030 bid. Like, this was one of John Delaney's jobs back in from the Jonathan Hall report. In Gibraltar, how would we ever forget it back in whenever that was, years ago now. But anyway, like, the World Cup was on the horizon then. I distinctly remember months later being at, it was the last time I think it was out of the country, a European UEFA gig in Bucharest when John Delaney was gone. And there was a meeting there between the five associations chatting about it. And just listening to Jack Chambers there, I hear you say earlier he wouldn't come on the show in general. It's been a while since we've been trying to get him on. But, like, listening to it there, I'm sort of wondering, like, do you know what's actually been happening with this process so far? Going on about Cork and Limerick and all this stuff. Like, from what I gather, the early discussions were very much only about the Aviva and Croke Park, because they're the only two that would meet the criteria in any way. You need a 40,000 capacity stadium, all seated, you know, to host a group game. You need 60,000 or bigger to have a quarter final onwards. So the Aviva's actually out of it. So you need Croke Park. And basically, the big problem they have with the bid is there's no suitable stadium in Northern Ireland at all. The Windsor Park has already been done, and that won't be up to it. And the new Casement Park, notwithstanding sort of political aspects with that, that will also fall short of it. You would need FIFA to provide a substantial, FIFA would need to bend their own rules to allow that to happen, to allow any of those other stadiums in without unbelievable expense and work. And that's not necessarily a great sell when you're competing against other bids that won't have any of those issues. So now, in fairness, I do think that the people who have been involved in this bid for some time are aware of all that and have been working off the basis primarily of the Aviva and Croke Park being the only two realistic shows in town. So a lot of the other stuff in the chat around it today, to be frank, has been absolute and utter garbage. Including that segment you played there. going on about the football and family and all this. Absolute. And in fairness to Jack Chambers, I think actually he's been, you know, been quite good on some stuff recently around sort of providing reassurance for football. And I think the FAI would be conscious of, you know, they've built a strong relationship with government with regard to, let's be honest, a bailout effectively of Irish football. And I think that the government has been quite helpful to the FAI. So maybe the FAI just has to sit back and listen to this politics, you know, and listen to this Micheál Martin getting doorstepped today, you know, almost out of breath dealing with this great positive news that the country has been. This is very exciting that the feasibility study launched in 2018. The news is it's still a feasibility study. But Boris is going to put some more money towards this feasibility study. So listen, let's all dream. Let's all dream of what can happen. Meanwhile, what's actually been going on in the real world is that there's, and I've been, this has been a discussion in the last couple of weeks, is that a real problem that the bid, which has been moved for some time, is going to face, is that when you within UEFA, there's thought to be a, quite a degree of support for Spain, the Spain-Portugal bid. So in to pick it in football, you know, football parlance, you know, they've got a job to get out of their group if they decide to go through with the bid, never mind actually, you know, win the tournament itself. So let's just not get carried away here. But I mean, it's too late. It's the political story of the day. So who are we to question it?
Whew. Okay.
Anything else on that you want to discuss? What about the Samba boys in what about the Samba boys in the Semple Stadium? What about that? What a lift that would be for the morale of the country, you know? What about fixing some of our problems in football in the country here first, rather than this big picture, you know, stuff? Now, to be fair, listen, the government have probably stepped forward and helped Irish football a bit in recent times, you know, in times of need. So I don't think you can necessarily be as down on them as you might have been in the past in that regard. Mm-hmm. But like this like getting excited by World Cup bids and major tournament bids is the type of stuff that people love. This stuff, you know, people get into this stuff, but really there's no substance to what they're talking about in the last 24 hours. There really hasn't been any development at all. And as I said, they have a real effort to do. Like I mean, we have to be conscious that like a British-led bid in Europe presents some complications at the moment when you're trying to get Europe on board with you. Mm. And it's Brexit Britain at the front of the bus saying, come with us, rather than the Spain-Portugal bid, you know? So, like, there's a couple of problems with this. Like, there'd be five nations trying to compete. They wouldn't all get the, barring, like, a dramatic change in policy, all five wouldn't automatically qualify, contrary to what you might hear people say. This is a great way to qualify for the World Cup. That actually hasn't been established. So, I mean, Canada are hosting 2026 and still don't know if they're in the competition yet. So, there's a lot of issues. Right. A lot of issues.
So, what you're saying effectively is, this feasibility study dates back to 2018. Theresa May had signed off on it. Had the Irish government signed off on it as well?
The government have always indicated they've been positive towards it. Okay. I don't recall a publicity blitz like this, but certainly, you know, the world changed a bit in an FAI context in 2019. But I mean, I don't recall any negative noises around it, certainly, you know. It's been actually around and tipping away for so long. All that our lot have done today is follow the lead of what Boris said. And Boris is the second prime minister to support the feasibility study, you know. So
That's interesting because I didn't quite understand where all this had come from. So I know that the UK government are having their budget on Wednesday, and as part of that, Boris Johnson says it's the right time for the UK and the Republic of Ireland to launch a joint bid to host the 2030 World Cup. I'm reading here. The UK government will pledge 2.8 million sterling to kickstart the process in Wednesday's budget. So you're saying this process is already underway, but they're kickstarting the process is the way it's been presented to everybody. And Boris said, it's the home of football. It's the right time. It's time for football to come home. And everybody's got pretty excited here. But Theresa May had already signed off.
I was trying to get the actual quotes up, but I don't quite have them in front of me. But certainly September 2018, yeah, the 29th of September, The Guardian, Theresa May backs joint UK and Ireland bid to host 2030 World Cup.
So this, I mean, this really is an especially cynical, let's just shape the news cycle of a Tuesday.
100%. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah. And listen, I mean, you would say it's so transparent that, you know, people shouldn't fall for it. But hey, look, it's been everywhere all day as though this hasn't happened before. It's amazing, really. It's how it works, you know. But like, I mean, as I said, like, I mean, like Jonathan Hill spoke on this topic at length last Friday, and spoke actually very well, probably way more significant than anything that happened yesterday. Was Jonathan Hill, the new FAI CEO, speaking about it last Friday in real detailed terms, speaking about how the two English bids had floundered in the past and how possibly they had learned from that and realised that, like, adding some Irish accents into it and an Irish flavour might help. And he said significantly, you know, particularly at UEFA level. And that's important because this bid has a battle to win to get UEFA support. So
we're a very charming people. The listeners are loving the cut of your jib this evening, by the way.
Well, that's good to hear, Joe.
Loving it. Christ, Dan is right. I thought this myself. Good news will defeat the bad news. Somebody else. Seriously, Joe, we really do get what we vote for. Vacuous claptrap. Paul says, this is a Dan McDonald tour de force. Take that, Chambers. Your boys took one hell of a beating this evening.
I'll take that.
Dan, you'll be laughing on the other side of your face when we're all heading to Armour Park to see Ghana versus the Netherlands on a sunny Friday evening, says Noel. And you know what, Dan? You bloody will and all. I'll be playing this back to you in 2030.
But you know, I guess what I'm saying is I don't think the bid's a complete no-hoper, right? I'm just saying that, like, a lot of the problems that the bid is going to face have already been sort of, you know, the associations are aware of them and I think have been speaking about them and have embraced, you know, and are conscious of it. You know, and I don't think the idea is a complete long shot, but just some of the stuff people are talking about, they're taking it around the country and all this stuff, it's not realistic if the bid is going to take off and go anywhere.
What about if we build a new 60,000-70,000 seater stadium in Leash?
Well, I mean, listen, maybe we should. Like, you know, is the Barack Obama Plaza near there? Like,
yeah,
is there
anything give or take.
Can we get Biden involved with this? You know, because he's obviously one of our own at this stage. I'm sure the next time we get to go to the White House for St. Patrick's Day, you know, we can get something out about that. And, you know, you can read all about it. You know, the political story of the year, Ireland bidding for World Cup. Yeah, I mean, what else could be going on at the moment?
So, I mean, okay. The English spent 23.
I'm not feeling your enthusiasm here, Joe.
Well, I don't know how to feel about all this. The English spent 23 million on their Prince William David Beckham-led bid in, I guess it would have been 2016 territory, for what became Russia 2018. So, I mean, these bid processes cost a lot of money. 23 million just to get into the final four, where they finished dead last. They got two votes out of 22. Now, they will spin that as, well, we were the only bloody ones not bribing everyone. So, I mean, like, we played by the rules. But either way, they finished last and they're going again. There's going to be a joint bid from Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, and of course Uruguay, the centenary of the first World Cup. As you mentioned, Spain and Portugal are looking to get together. Morocco are in the mix as well, and I'm sure there'll be somewhere else further afield. 2026, the World Cup has gone from 32 teams to 48, we should remind people. So there are going to be 80 matches. Hence, after banning joint bids after 2002 and Japan and Korea, we're now allowing joint bids again. So for 2026, when we get this Qatar business out of the way, we'll have USA, Canada and Mexico. As you said, there's still a few issues up in the air there. But in effect, 10 stadiums US, 3 in Mexico, 3 in Canada for the 2026 World Cup. So joint bids are back. You know, that's kind of the situation in a big way. Parking the cynicism. It's not actually cynicism. If it turns out that a feasibility study was launched in 2018, and all that's happened today is they've announced there's still a feasibility study.
They're putting more money behind it. Yeah,
okay, well, more money's something. Like, let's be fair, more money is something. 2.8 million.
Sterling. Get some architects. Yeah. Get some architects to draw plans.
Stuff like that, yeah. And Boris is excited. So, look, there's a degree of, well, we're serious about this today. Maybe they've overstretched themselves slightly, but there's a degree of seriousness about this. Parking the nauseating PR that's going to go with this thing over the next year, and it will be tough to take at times. Is it something we should be going for? Is this a good thing for Ireland to do? Does the cost-benefit ratio of hosting a World Cup make sense? Should any and all money which would go towards this be spent on the grassroots, and we should have nothing to do with this World Cup business, and FIFA can make their 5 billion another way? What is your take on that?
Yeah, see, I'm not convinced ultimately. Like, I mean, you know, it is a reality, and like people will say, well, this is just like typical moaning, but it is true. Like, it's 2021. You know, you have we have top division clubs in our country doing GoFundMes to get, you know, Portaloos sort of put on their ground to restart football. And yet we are talking about, you know, that's the Finn Harps one, who cannot get a stadium built in Donegal, you know, for years. And yet, you know, we're talking about sort of committing funds towards, a World Cup bid. And as I said, listen, the government have been quite supportive around Daly Mount Park and other projects. So I'm not just making this an anti, you know, state sort of, you know, attack on them. But I'm just saying that, like, we've a lot of other things to get our house in order with. And the extent to which, you know, a World Cup delivers like a land of milk and honey to us is disputed. We have a good example of this. Take the pandemic out of it, right? But we have the Euros this summer. And if we were meant to have it last summer, and if Ireland hadn't qualified, et cetera, et cetera, you know, having Poland, Slovakia and Sweden play Euros here, even with full stadiums, like what does this do for us? Like, if you have automatic, you know, the right to, Ireland will definitely be in it. You can imagine that would give a great boost to the game at all levels. You know, and commercially, there's great opportunities for football to profit around it, you know, which can go into the game, and you can spin the angle for that. And of course, people will say about, you know, tourism, value to the exchequer, someone will get a calculator out, multiply hotel rooms by a number of people, and come out with, like, you know, 4 billion or something to the economy, right? But like, the fact is that, you know,
so
with the Euros,
are you saying we make 4 billion?
Well, so you'll find someone to say in a press release. But the point is that, like, we had the Europa League final here, which was a great event in theory. But do you remember it? It was Porto against Braga. Like, I don't know if that, like, I think with a World Cup, and you're talking in many cases about group stage games, like, you know, would they, there's a lucky dip aspect in it.
And sorry to interrupt. Actually, I was going to ask you a question, but I just want to go to the Etihad because there has been a goal. Let's go to Adam Jury.
Man City 1, Wolves 1. How about this for a turn up for the books? Connor Cody has equalised for the visitors. It came about from a free kick whipped in by Moutinho. The Man City defenders didn't pick up Cody. He went in for a diving header, made the contact, and Edison couldn't quite reach the ball as it pinged into the bottom right corner of the net. Game on. Man City 1, Wolves 1.
There we are. Interesting. Connor Cody, good man. Darren Lovely says that the World Cup Irish government non-announcement, he's taking your lead here, Dan, reminded me of the scene in The Thick of It when they called a press conference to say there's actually no news, but we're all doing our jobs and it's business as usual.
I went through the thick of it back catalogue at the start of the pandemic, and I hadn't watched it before, to my shame. But the more time you spend around and with sort of the overlap with, you know, the FAI unraveling, and the more time you get to spend around the Dáil and Leinster House and all of that,
yeah,
you know, a couple of those committee hearings and stuff. You're struggling to figure out where satire ends and realism begins.
The problem with The Thick of It is your language goes through the dog, you know, goes to the dogs if you're watching it too much. But Owen Murphy, sort of, not fully, gets to the point I was going to put to you. He says, Ireland hosting a World Cup is the only way we're going to qualify for one, and maybe if we build a whitewater rafting facility in Dublin, we can host the Olympics too. On the first point, if we host World Cup matches in Dublin, and it will only be in Dublin, and actually, I think FIFA and UEFA are set against having multiple games in one city. They don't want, you know, four sets of fans. They generally just want two sets of fans to take over a city. But, I mean, that's all to be figured out. But regardless, would we not be talking then about a World Cup match involving Ireland? Group stages or no, doesn't really matter to me. And that would be kind of cool. Now, I'm not saying it's worth all the money.
Only if Ireland qualify.
But would we not qualify as part of this joint bid?
No, it's not guaranteed.
There's 48 teams.
Doesn't matter.
We couldn't even 48 teams. They'll let us
matter.
In. They'll let
doesn't
us
matter.
In. They'd let
no,
us
no,
in.
They won't. They haven't decided yet whether letting Canada, Mexico, United States, and all three are getting in 2026. That hasn't been decided. Now, I know the South Americans have four. But you know, again, this bid going to the market with five is saying, hey, everyone in the world, vote for us. But by the way, hey, Oceania or whoever, there'll be one, you know, one of you won't be going. So, like, this is one of the issues. Another issue they're going to face with the bid. It's pretty unlikely. Not impossible, because let's be honest, there's right and there's wrong and there's how you do a FIFA bid. I mean, But I'm just saying, like, you're looking for Boris to succeed where Beckham didn't on some of this stuff. You know, maybe they needed Boris rather than Beckham the last time round.
Is Boris not far more suited to this type of a job?
Do you know what? Maybe he is. Maybe I'll take that back. Maybe that's where it went wrong before. But like this is another issue that we face with this. But again, people have been slow to clarify this point. This didn't make it into the briefing to the political world about actually Ireland might not actually be in this thing that hasn't been clarified. Okay. Now, the one thing I would say, because again, this story has been knocking around for so long, and I should say there was this, it's possible that I've slept through the last couple of years and I've missed all of this happening and there's a terrible confusion. I've dreamt some of this. But there was a story at one stage that as part of the bidding process, there was a chat about maybe Croke Park for the opening game. A few people were sort of tossing this around as a discussion point that maybe if they could get Croke Park in it, part of the carrot would be it could have the opening game. And there would be a prestige with that, I guess, you know, with the World Cup starting here. And that has definitely been discussed before, but which is again just speaks to the point that this has been going on for ages. And that actually is, you know, you could actually probably sell that angle, but I'm not sure where that aspect of it actually where that stands at the moment.
So what are you saying to me then? If we take away all the, as I said, nauseating PR that will go with it, do you think this is a suitable way for Irish sport to spend its money? Like Nathan made the point at the start of the show that really. This should come out of the tourism budget. This should not come out of any money which could go to grassroots sports. I thought that was a very fair suggestion. Like should it detract from sporting facilities around the country? I don't think it should. But you know, money is going to come from somewhere. So if it comes from tourism, that might affect the sporting budget. Either way, it'll be a serious amount of money spent. Is it worth it? Is kind of a question.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that it is, really. You know, it's not as if it's like, you know, in the political world where you get no votes and you get your entry fee back or something. Like, you know, if you go through with this bid, which they still haven't decided to do, you know, if you decide to go through with it, and to be fair, I think at a UEFA level, they'll find out whether it's worth going through with it or not. They'll sort of, you know, it'll be laid down where they're going. You know, it's a spend to go through with it. And like my point is, like, you know, you're doing well to get functioning Wi-Fi in sort of grounds in our country here, you know, and yet we're talking about a World Cup bid in 2030. Like at the moment, you know, there's grassroots footballers up and down the country who don't know when they're going to play again. And yet they're seeing stuff in the news about bidding for a 2030 World Cup. It's in Congress in a way. Like I understand. Listen, to some degree, I think they've been at the FAI initially were asked into this. I think the a lot of the heavy lifting is going to be done by the English FA in many respects.
Yeah.
And I think that the Irish wing is just going to be a wing of it. And that's almost my point. It would be a small part of the tournament, not this Cork, Limerick, around the country sort of craft that people are going on about, right? Like it would be a small part of the tournament and a bit like the Euro 2020 where we have a wing of games and there's an element of potluck about what you get if Ireland aren't in it. Mm. And will we look at that in 2030 and go, if Ireland got through all of this, which is a massive if, you know, what was it worth it? I mean, listen, maybe people would say we're being utterly cantankerous here. We're being Grinches, you know, World Cup in Ireland. You're all on board the Express.
I don't know what I think, but
you'll be introducing the fans to a fan zone of some description.
Well, look, if there's corporate work in it for me, then I think we should discuss it a bit more.
I can see you doing that. But like the point is that like maybe we should go, listen, once in a lifetime chance to say we have the World Cup here. But I always have the view with these big tournaments bids, and I was the same with Euro 2020. I'd love it to be the culmination of a process where people can come to our country for this tournament and say, yes, come to Ireland. This is a modern football nation. Look what we've done with our stadiums here. Look what we've done. And this is a culmination of our work, rather than we have what we have. The foundations here are still very shaky or in some places don't exist. Yeah. And let's put a big trophy tournament on top of it. But like that my whole point is that trophy tournament, that let's get out there, is like completely indicative of the political class's relationship with Irish sport. Mm. It's very much about, this is Charlie Haughey waiting for Stephen Roach. You know, this is about being front and centre, you know, in 1994 when people are coming down O'Connell Street or whatever, but then sort of not really been anywhere to be seen when aspects of the game here are like dying, you know, and infrastructure is non-existent. Mm. But hang on, there's a tournament bid. Well, listen, get me out there. Show me the cameras. Let's talk about this, because this would be great for the football family and for the nation. If you want to do something that's properly great for the football family, I think it's about building something from the bottom up, supporting that. And then it would be brilliant in 15, 20 years if we could have a tournament here and people could say, yeah, this is a country that gets its business done in football. But that's not the case at the moment. Yeah. So I guess I'm coming down with no. That would be my conclusion on that one.
That is very fair. We'll take a short break.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now, you're very welcome back. Myself and Dan McDonald here with you. Let's check in for the latest at the Etihad.
Man City 1, Wolves 1. Connor Cody's 61st minute goal has given this game a different complexion about it. Now it's City's turn to look uncomfortable, and mistakes are creeping into their game. Wolves can smell blood, and they've started to spring attacks on the counter. Traore and Neto's pace, it's causing problems for City's defence, and they've come close with a few efforts on goal. City could be in danger of losing this, which in the first half was unthinkable. It's Man City 1, Wolves 1 at the Etihad.
Yeah, interesting. Adam Drury there at the Etihad. Now, we wanted to mark the passing of Ian St. John. He's passed away at the age of 82. Randy described as an iconic figure in Liverpool's history, and to pay tribute, very happy to say Mark Lawrenson is with us this evening.
Hi, Joe.
I had a look back a couple of years ago. You were listing off the 10 most influential players at Liverpool, and Ian St. John made your list, so you held him in extremely high regard.
Christ, I can't even remember doing it, Joe. Yeah. Well, I think so. Obviously, Shankly. Once Shankly got there, and then he started to build his team, and he bought Saint, didn't he? But wasn't that the story with the I think it was 35 grand, and the board said, we haven't got 35 grand. He said, well, you'll need to find it because we're taking him. Mm. And I think so. And then they bought Big Rod, Ronnie Yates. So I was talking to someone today about it all, and I said, you know what? I said, it's a bit, those two players going there with Shankly was a bit like Alisson and Van Dijk going with Klopp, almost not final pieces of the jigsaw, but certainly the boost and the kick to give the rest of the players in the squad that extra kind of kick on, and you know, and were obviously quality players. I mean, Saint was he was only 5'8", and if you think about it, he played in a little bit off Roger Hunt. I mean, Roger Hunt just scored goals for fun, didn't he? And they had I think Peter Thompson on the left wing, Ian Callan on the right. But Saint would scrap with anybody. He was just that's the way that he was. And for a relatively small fella, he was really, really fiery. But he was also a very, very good player and a good team man as well.
Mm. 118 goals in 425 appearances. So he arrived at Anfield in May 1961, as you said, for the £35,000 record signing then at that stage. So I make it around then you're about 4 years of age. So do you remember him playing? Were you watching him?
No. I tell you what I can remember. The first thing I can remember was the cup final against Leeds when he scored with the diving header. Was that 65?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know how I know that, Joe?
Go on.
Because the year before, Preston win the final against West Ham. Mm. So that kind of kick-started the fact. It was the year after North End. We're unlucky after twice being in front.
Yeah. And he won two league titles, as you said, that goal and the FA Cup final as well. Mm. And a good teammate, you say. So you've been talking to a few people who obviously were around him today.
Yeah. Well, no, I think he was a fab teammate. And I think both himself and Big Ronnie Yates, because they were massive buddies, that they stood up to Shanks. You know, if they disagreed with something that Shanks had said or done, they stood up to him. And I think they were a very, very strong dressing room. And I know football was extremely different in the 60s, and you can only talk about your time when you actually played. But they ran the dressing room, and there were never, ever, ever any problems, I was told, that Shankly had to come in and sort out, because the players sorted out between them. And the majority of the time it was the Saint and Big Ron Yates as well.
Mm. I was reading, it jumped out to me, I was amazed to see this. It was on the BBC website. He won 21 Scotland caps. A meagre amount, they say, for a player of such talent. But it was a fate that befell many of the so-called Anglos, who were out of sight, out of mind to those in charge of Scotland at the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, Hanson and Dalglish had it. I mean, it got to such a thing with Alan, with Big Al Hansen, that he wasn't that bothered about going to play for Scotland because he got so much abuse. Kenny was different, obviously, because Kenny was a genius north and south of the border. But Big Al was like, oh Christ, it's international week next week. But yeah, they were all like it, and I think the kind of feeling generally in Scotland was once you cross that border to go and play in England, it was like, no, see you later. So yeah, I think there's quite a few of them sort of suffered with the go round, take the money down south, but come back to play for Scotland, no thanks.
Mm. Dan, do you remember Saint and Greavesy?
Yeah.
I do. I do. Sorry, no, but I think...
I know you do, Mark.
I think the point here, Mark, is that Joe doesn't, because he's just got that bit of a couple of years youth there, and he doesn't remember them. I don't want to misquote you, Joe, but
no,
for me, sort of growing up in the 80s, when football on TV was like a treat rather than like saturation, like Saint and Greavesy was like... You know, in the same way, it was related to like the ITV Sunday afternoon match being the only live football that you would see on TV. And Saint and Greavesy were like, you know, inextricably linked with the coverage and the chat and the sort of discussion around football. So it's an early memory for me. And I'm sure there's probably people listening who, you know, who are maybe a couple of years older would have much more clear memories. But yeah, very much so. And like I was actually going to ask, you know, Lauro, you look at sort of the modern player now and how they all sort of love Neville and Carragher. And I know Saint and Greavesy was more lighthearted, I'm guessing there wasn't that much football on the TV. I'm guessing it was a show you probably all watched as players, and you were following it on a regular basis.
Well, we would, because if you think about it, also everybody played on Saturday at 3 o'clock. So their show came on about 12-ish. I think obviously the BBC still had Football Focus on the other side, but Saint and Greavesy came on about 12 o'clock. I think they probably went in direct opposition to Football Focus, and they were different and they were funny. They were still obviously quite serious about the football, but it was just always a really good watch, and you'd be having a bit of a laugh and stuff. But I think, and I don't mean this in any kind of strange way, but we were all very much captive audiences, because generally we, as teams, we ate at 12 o'clock before 3 o'clock. Mm. And we ate steak, which was nuts when you think about it, but everyone thought it was a good idea. So literally you'd wolf your meal down straight away, and then you'd go in the TV room if you're at a hotel because you're playing away from home to watch Saint and Greavesy.
And so was it akin to Football Focus? Like they were talking about the serious issues of the day? It wasn't just messing around?
Not really.
Okay.
No, they didn't really do serious issues, Joe. They were just generally light-hearted. It was where Saint came up with where Greavesy came up with it's only a game, Saint, in it, and all those kind of things. But it was light-hearted and it was fun.
Yeah. I think you take a nod from that into your approach, don't you?
Well, it's not life or death, is it?
No.
So, you know, it is what it is. Although my name now seems... I've lost Laura. I'll come out as Victor. As in Meldrew. So you laughing? Everyone laughs when I tell them, and you obviously think, yeah, you're right.
I've no idea. I've no idea how they came up with that.
Right, whatever.
Hey, listen, a bit of dry wit is a badly missed thing on TV. Don't ever change.
Well, you should be sprightly to open your mouth sometimes, aren't you?
So, condolences to all concerned. It's very sad.
Yeah.
82 years of age and huge figure in Liverpool's history. I suspect they'll mark it this week. They play Chelsea. One of the lads outside would just sent me on the list of Liverpool injuries this year and said it'd be interesting to get your take on it. So it's staggering when you see this. So let me just give you an abbreviated version. This isn't even everything. Alisson, this is all before Christmas, for instance. Alisson with the thigh injury, Milner hamstring, Keita hamstring, Henderson hamstring, Shaqiri had a muscular injury, Joe Gomez, the tendon rupture, Trent had a calf strain, Fabio Tavares hamstring, Keita again, muscular injury, Joe Matip, muscular injury, Van Dijk, obviously that was a freak incident, Thiago, knee, Alisson, again, a shoulder injury. Henderson, again, quad strain. Joe Gomez, again, knee injury. After Christmas, Jota, muscle injury, and Henderson again, hip injury. So it's an unbelievable list. It is leading the sports scientists out there, the amateurs, to wonder if, you know, well, one, the team were on the road a long time, but two, Klopp, gegenpressing, Dortmund, there was a big fall-off. Is something happening here? Man City, it seems, tailored their training pre-season to allow for the fact they didn't have a proper pre-season and they're coming good now. Not that they haven't had injuries themselves, but that list does catch the eye, doesn't it? Whatever's going on. Is there much talk about that around the club?
Not greatly. I think the City thing, because they were ninth for a few weeks, weren't they, at the start of the season?
Yeah.
So obviously they were very slow to get up to speed. And of course, Klopp would demand that, you know, first game of the season they had to be at full speed. But I think as well, because there wasn't much of a break in between the two seasons, the way they train. I mean, pre-season, he does three sessions a day, Jurgen Klopp. Now, it's worked for 2 or 3 years, but obviously this season it's been a particular problem. But I think this happens always. I remember certainly 1 year at Liverpool where I tore my Achilles. I kept dislocating my shoulder, I think, three times, did it? I think Kevin McDonald had a really, really bad broken leg. Jim Beglin broke his leg really, really bad. And we just had one of those years. We never changed the way that we trained, ever. Now, you might say those days are nothing to do with the pitches, it might be do this and that and the other, but broken legs certainly aren't. So, I think it is very, very intense. But he's Klopp's people will have looked all the data. They put these kind of waistcoat things on, don't they? And they know exactly who's running and how far and all those kind of things. So they'll have done all that. But I just think they've been seriously unlucky. And it happens.
It does, yeah. They have the best people working there. It's just one of these freak things. But they've had 17 injuries to Spurs is 12, Man City 12, Chelsea 8, United 7. So 17 for Liverpool.
What about Leicester?
Leicester up to 6 now. I'm questioning that 6. They've had more than 6, haven't they?
I think they're in double figures.
Yeah, I took a screen grab the other day. I think even at the moment they have Fofana, Justin, Madison, Pratt, Perez, Morgan, Barnes, Evans. So they've at least 8 on the go anyway.
Yeah. So and I bet they've not done anything different.
Mm. No, it's difficult to know.
Although they've got a new training ground with a golf course in it, so that'll probably get the blame.
I've been told to go over to the Etihad. Adam Jury is there.
Man City 2, Wolves 1, and Gabriel Jesus has put City back in front, and at a critical time too. It came about when the ball was passed down onto the right-hand side. Kyle Walker burst forward, crossed into the box. The Wolves defence didn't deal with it properly. It fell to Gabriel Jesus 6 yards out. All he had to do was poke it in, and he made no mistake. Man City 2, Wolves 1.
There we go. No real surprise. That will be Mark Lawrence in 21 matches and counting when they see this one.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, and I think the biggest thing is the two centre backs just absolutely totally made all the difference to that team. And they're both obviously, you know, football playing centre backs, but they've not conceded any goals. Hardly the goalkeeper never gets too much praise, but he's had an outstanding season. So they'll win the league by probably second week in April, if not first.
It's looking that way. As a defender, had you looked at Stones and given up on him?
Yeah, I had a little bit because I know a lot about Stones, because I remember when Moisey took him from, I think he was at Barnsley, wasn't he? I think he was playing right back. He's either Barnsley or Rotherham, and he took him to Everton.
Yeah.
Barnsley. And everybody had looked at him. Joe, it's one of those, you get a really good player in the Championship, and everybody goes and looks, and they kind of make him the thing. Can he play in the Premier League? What if Thierry Henry runs at him and all that kind of stuff? And I think because everybody looked and thought, not sure, and in the end, Mr. Not Sure himself took him. And he said straight away, he said he's going to be a centre-back, he said, because he's excellent on the ball, he's recovery is really, really good, and we just need to teach him in the proper art of defending. And it's a difficult one, because did he go to City for 50 mil?
Yeah, about that.
And I mean, sometimes, you know, that can turn your head. And also, you know, you walk into a dressing room that's full of massive stars where you've gone from Everton, where they're not massive stars, there's some very, very good players, but it's not the same, and you've got this £50 million price tag on your head, and you feel you've got to do something just to sort of say to people, you know, that's why I'm 50 million, because I'm a really, really good player. And I think he made a few mistakes, suffered a bit, you know, lacks of concentration, and completely lost his confidence. And, you know, he's always been a really, really good footballer, but now he just actually defends properly.
Yeah, it's nice to see him back. It would have been a real waste. For Liverpool this year, I guess finishing fourth is about it, and get this season behind them, forget about it, and reconvene and feel good about life with a fresh season. That's the aim, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, because, I mean, especially with the pandemic, in return of no supporters, and they have lost a lot of money. And obviously, you know, it's about the revenue stream as well. So to get back in the Champions League, you know, then I'm not sure if, who or when, why they'll buy players in the summer. I would have thought that they will, but it might make the difference if they're actually in the Champions League. Well, it will make the difference if they're in the Champions League. And what I would say about the American owners is that, you know, I think when Klopp's gone to them, when he's gone now, look, you know, as in, when he really needed a goalkeeper after the Champions League final, and he went, look, and he's 70 odd million, whatever it was, and they went, yeah, we'll do it. So, yeah, it'd be interesting. No, it's one of them, and it just get to fourth or better and get out of town.
Yeah.
Get yourselves a holiday and come back next season ready.
Yeah, well, they have Chelsea on Thursday, I think, so we'll see how they go. Marco, it was great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Cheers. Mark Lawrence, and they're paying tribute to Ian St. John. That was initially certainly the reason he was on. So Jonathan Wilson writing today saying Ian St. John was a gifted broadcaster, the perfect straight man for Jimmy Greaves. I really do feel, Dan, I've missed out on something with that show. Because it was only on for about 6-7 years, and yet for a generation talk about it as if it was like match of the day on for decades. It was like this huge thing. I wish I'd seen it at the time.
I think it's probably because a lot of people are the age that remember it.
Yeah.
Are probably sort of, you know, the youngest ones would be sort of late 30s, early 40s, you know, and it's sort of that's, you know, a lot of people are now at a stage where they're older, looking back and reflecting on their time. And as I said, like, I remember it-ish, like, you know, I remember Greavesy being a sort of a jokey character, you know, and I recall watching it because there was so little to watch. I actually forgotten that it went head-to-head with Football Focus. It almost felt like it was one of the few things there was on. I didn't think it was a clash, but maybe there was. But certainly it was definitely a very different style of football coverage, like more so of the era, you know, more lighthearted. I know I sort of mentioned Neville and Carragher there, but it couldn't be any more different. Like it was more sort of jovial and less serious. But I guess I was more so saying, though, it was of the day. You know, I'm sure, you know, people just talked about, did you see what St. Greasy said? Because they didn't have much more reference point for their pundits, if you know what I mean, in terms of, well, you know, the match had a rotating one. And, of course, Match of the Day was an institution in its own way. But I think, like, the rights went, you know, BBC didn't have rights for a period of time and stuff as well. So in that sort of late 80s, early 90s, things were sort of flittering around a bit.
OK. Football on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.